It is the follow-up of the Brzee Institute that was formed in Los Angeles, where I co-founded it in 1983 to do training in urban and compassionate ministries. It was very successful. Doug Fleming was one of our graduates who spent time here in the Philippines. And so it has been a privilege for me. And about 4 years ago, I got the idea, you know, really, the Philippines ought to be the hub of what we're trying to do. I'm no longer the director. That task has been passed on to Tammy Condon, my assistant. But my focus is here in the Philippines. And the focus is to develop a PhD program. We're meeting right after chapel to put together the curriculum in the area of transformational development in complex contexts. That's the title that tentatively we're giving it. But I've had the privilege of teaching in 46 of the 100 largest cities in the world. And so I think it's given me a perspective. But I think the Philippines is an amazing place for this kind of training to take place. So pray. I don't cost Nazarene headquarters or the Global Ministry Center anything. We raise our own funds. And I'm here because of the generosity of people who are contributing in other places. Yesterday, or 2 days ago, I took you on a trip. We went to, where did we go? We went to Sri Lanka. We went to India. We went to Nagaland and other places. I want to continue that trip with you. By the way, I'm wearing this. This is kind of symbolic. I bought this in Kenya when I was teaching at Africa Nazarene University. I wanted to buy it for my son. You know, it looks so African. And people talk about dark Africa, but there's nothing dark about this shirt and the colors that it contains. And Africa is a very vibrant continent. When I got home, I looked at the tag and it said, Made in Thailand. By the way, one of the jokes that goes over best when I'm teaching internationally is this. What do you call somebody who speaks multiple languages? Polyglot. What do you call a person who speaks two languages? Bilingual. What do you call a person who speaks one language? American. And one of the reasons why I am here is because this is a place where you learn to speak in many languages. Not just verbally, but by gestures, by love, by interest, by foods, by habits, and so forth. So we want to go off now to Pakistan. But first, I've got a scripture verse I want to leave with you. This is a verse that was given to me in a letter, personal letter, from Elizabeth Elliot many years ago. I said, why is it that when your husband was murdered by the Auca Indians, you picked up your little daughter and you went back to live with them? And this was the verse that she gave me. You are my witnesses and my people whom I have chosen, that you may know and believe that I am He. That kind of stunned me. First of all, next slide. That's right. You can go ahead and do the slides for me, okay? Witnesses also has the double meaning of martyrs. Something dies in order for you to become a witness. We lose something. We lose something of our own particular culture. There are some in missions that say, for you to be an effective witness cross-culturally, you reduce yourself from 100% engaged in one culture to 75%, and you pick up 75% of the other culture so that you become a 150% person, much more whole than if you remain monocultural. We learn to give up our politics. We learn to give up our prejudices. We learn to give up our comforts. In the Philippines, you learn to give up your privacy and many other things. But that's part of what it means to be a witness. And then the phrase, whom I have chosen. Everybody who comes to Jesus Christ is chosen. I'm kind of down on the word missionary because we've created two-tiered kind of understanding of missions. There are those that are missionaries, and then there's the proletariat. The fact is, every one of us is called to be a missionary. We are sent, and we are sent across boundaries and borders, not necessarily in other countries, but right here in your own neighborhood. It's not an option, but a calling for all Christians. And it's the collective witness of a community. And we are hand-selected for unique purposes. And then the phrase that really turns it on its head for me is that you may know and believe that I am He. But I thought the missionaries were there to make them know and believe that I am He. Part of my concern with Americans nowadays is our religion is so superficial that we don't find ourselves really understanding who God is anymore. It's only as you become a witness and put yourself on the edge of risk to be that witness, to be the martyr, that God reveals Himself at the deeper and deeper levels of our lives. Okay, let's travel now. Next. I have spent the last 3 years in Multan, Pakistan. It's not a very comfortable place. The temperatures run 115, 120 degrees when I'm there. The power is on and off, and oftentimes the air conditioning, what little there is not even available, or fans, or anything else. The food is not necessarily my favorite. What I see there is a broken nation seeking some kind of alternative. The population right now is 180 million, but it'll be the fourth most populous nation in the world by the year 2050. Does God care about Pakistan? I believe He does, because He's got an awful lot of His creation there. Church of the Nazarene, don't believe those statistics. That's what we proclaimed 5 years ago. But we've had some major scandals, and many of those churches have wandered off. I have not affiliated with the Church of the Nazarene in Pakistan because we've got some problems there. Pray for the Nazarene Church in Pakistan. Next. When I was in Lahore at the airport, just leaving the country last year, I saw this beautiful plate. It was filled with beads, pieces of glass, mirrors. It was so beautiful, and I wanted to take it home to my wife. We packaged it up carefully. I put it in my suitcase, and when I got back home, with great excitement, I unwrapped it, and the beads and the pieces of the glass all started falling out. I discovered it was cracked and broken. I was about ready to throw it in the trash when I suddenly realized this is a metaphor of the nation of Pakistan. A broken nation, broken by corruption, broken by the divide between the very rich and the very poor, broken between the various tribal groups that are fighting for supremacy, broken between the international plays that are being made by the international powers, broken in so many different ways. Broken between Christians, Muslims, between Shias and Sunnis. It has become a symbol of brokenness. A week ago last Sunday, I was supposed to be teaching this past summer in the city of Peshawar. The last minute they decided maybe it was a little too dangerous. Last Sunday, 500 to 600 Christians were assembled for prayer meeting in the Anglican Church. There in Peshawar. As they walked on out, two suicide bombers bombed. 83 Christians were killed in the most horrific major disaster for Christians in the recent history of Pakistan. This is their bodies. They went to church praying. They left dead. Next. This is a sign, well, I should say it's a street corner filled with zillions of signs. I can't read any of them. I stand there confused. And I think so many Pakistanis are also very confused because they're getting mixed messages and they don't know which direction to go. Next, they insist that I color my hair dark. They don't want me to look too Western. In fact, I'm basically imprisoned when I'm in Pakistan. I can't walk freely on the streets. I wear most of the time Pakistani pajamas. I'm transported by vans from one site to another site where I'm ministering in five different cities. I have no opportunity for exercise. It's a very strange lifestyle that I've not experienced in any other country. This is in the community of Carnaval. I have 130 students. If you notice, the women are on the right-hand side, the men are on the left-hand side. It is a city in which 15 million girls have no access to education. But in my classes, they come pouring on in. Most of these are Christians. Many of them are Catholics. In this picture here, we're in the city of Multan. You can see there's a little different socioeconomic level. And some of those that are there are actually Muslims. Most of them Shia Muslims. Next. And so I'm teaching the theology of work, which becomes a wonderful excuse to teach the very basics of doctrine, who God is, who we are, what creation means, what was God's intent for us, and for the work that we do. And so it gives me an opportunity because these young people rarely see a Westerner and they have very poor knowledge even of their Christian principles. And this gives me an opportunity of access. Next, some of the Shiites in my class were so moved by what was going on in the class that they made arrangements for me to go to the mosques. The Shia mosques. And they greet me with great ceremony. Before I ever walk in, there's a long line of the leaders. They're throwing rose petals on me. And when I walk on in, they put the lei around my neck. And then I walk on in. The fellow on the right there, he is the imam in the mosque there. Present some flowers. I sit down in the middle of the mosque. And we have conversation for about an hour and a half. Why am I there? What do I represent? And I have absolute freedom to talk about Jesus Christ and his meaning in my life. They ask me for prayer, and I pray for them. They ask me again for prayer. And then this past year, I had the opportunity. I said, would you mind for our prayer time when it's the public prayers for me to sing? They said, sure. And I started to sing, Alleluia, 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 Alleluia. I'm not quite sure what they're hearing. Maybe they're hearing Allah. Who knows? But they know I'm Christian, and they know I'm praising God. By the way, did you notice the Coke and the potato chips that they offered us? Extremely hospitable. And I made the rounds of a number of these mosques with something of the same kind of opportunity. I give the imam a book. It's a book on conversations with people in other religions. Ironically, 4 years ago, I wrote the chapter on conversation with Muslims. And the people that I interviewed were Pakistanis. I had no knowledge that I'd be using this book in Pakistan, published by Nazarene Publishing House. Next. Also, I'm invited to the Hindu temples. And this is the Hindu priest. And this is the professor of Hindu theology for the children. I'm giving her a little flower. They're greeting me very warmly. This picture, by the way, was taken in the dark. You see, right behind me is an altar. It's the altar with the very strange symbols of animals and strange human fixtures and so forth. And it's all lit up in a very bizarre fashion. And the priest is walking me down in front of the altar, and I'm praying, oh Lord, I don't want to give the wrong message here. As I walk up to it, the power goes out, the whole room turns black. And I'm turned away from the altar. To me, it was a statement of Baal disappearing, no longer with any power. And so now I sit down. You see some of the children in the background. I'm having the same kind of conversation with the Hindu priest, with the people that are there. And at the end of it, after prayer, after singing again, I give them a copy of the book. And then I ask for the right to start to sing. I start to sing, and all the children jump up around me. And now they crowd around me, and they're singing Alleluia with me there in the Hindu temple. In fact, they're singing it so well, we sing it two times over. We sing it three times over. And I'm just feeling just an unusual excitement that here I am in a Hindu temple and all of these children are praising Yahweh God. Afterwards, the priest came and said, can you set up Christian Bible studies here in the temple? And we've been working on that. A big opportunity was when they invited me to make a major presentation at the Ramada Inn, inviting 25 of the top religious leaders. We were expecting 25. 50 showed up. Four of them were the Sunni scholars. If you know the politics, the Sunnis are killing the Shiites. They consider them a deviant religion. And it's the first time I'm told that the Sunnis and the Shiites were actually in the same room without trying to kill each other. And so here they are, sitting, observing, and I'm to give the speech, how our faith values shape religions and make Pakistan stronger. Here are some of those. We've got Hindus, Sunnis, Sufi Muslims, Shia, and Christians there. This is the head Sunni scholar for the city of Multan. I'm handing him the book. And praying for him. Standing behind me is the head Shia there in Multan. Unusual picture for the two of them to be together. Next. Here I am giving my presentation. Next. And then a group of them, not all of them, gathered outside for a group picture after we provided the meal for them. Next. This time around, I had talked to the head Shia imam. One of his six names, by the way, is Muhammad, as they all have the name Muhammad. He's sitting there beside me, and I had said to him in passing, after he'd showed me the medical dispensary that they had there on the Muslim compound, next time I come, I would like very much to bring some medicines for you. At General Assembly, I saw Gary Morsch, who had founded, of course, Heart to Heart. Gary, I need some medicines. He said, what for? I want to take them to the Muslims in Pakistan. Strange request. He said, let me get on the phone. I hereby authorize that you take a relief kit with medicines worth $10,000. You can pick them up in Kansas City. I picked them up in Kansas City. What I didn't realize is you've got to have documents for this to move it from one country to another country to another country. I had no documents. I didn't even have the full name of the organization or the name of the imam that I was delivering it to. And I had six countries to go through before I got to Pakistan. So now what am I going to do? Well, I got into South Korea without a problem. Nobody asked me any questions. And then I come to the Philippines. As I'm coming on through, the customs agent stops me. What's in that case? I said, medicines. Where's your paperwork? I don't have any paperwork. I'm in transit. I'm taking the medicines to Pakistan. No, sir, you're not in transit. You've already gone through immigration. You're now in the Philippines. And you're staying here for 5 days. You have no right to bring those medicines into the country. We are going to confiscate them. Oh, Lord, please, what do I do now? We have a discussion. At the end of the discussion, I ask, is there no other option? Yes, there is. We can fine you and assess the value of this, and you're going to have to pay in cash. I don't have cash. Well, there's an ATM over there. Well, I didn't have much money. But I go to the ATM. I change some money into pesos. They wanted $180. Well, for $10,000 worth of medicines, $180 isn't too bad, but it's about all I had. I pay off. They sign off. I walk into the Philippines with my box of medicines. Now I've got a problem. I'm praying real hard. Lord, I've got 3 more countries to go through. I've got to go through Singapore. I've got to go through Sri Lanka. And then I've got to go through Pakistan. I don't have any more money to pay out like this. Fortunately, I was able to book my stuff through Singapore into Sri Lanka. I get into Sri Lanka. Nobody raises a question. Now I get into Pakistan. I know there's going to be problems there. And so I put the case underneath my suitcase, and then I put my briefcase on top of it, hoping nobody would notice. As I'm going on through, blissfully looking very secure, the custom agent stops. He leans down. He says, what's that sound that I hear? I said, I don't know. Well, sir, would you keep moving, please? And then I'm through that one. Now I come to the next one. He stops. I hear a strange sound. Remember, this is Pakistan. They're afraid of bombs. And there are strange sounds coming out of my suitcase. Now this one says, would you please open up your suitcase? I open it up. We finally get into my toiletry kit. And there is my electric shaver. God has turned it on. I turn it off. He laughs. He says, you can go now. God's got some strange and funny ways of getting you through customs. You understand? And I delivered the box. And now they have asked me to pray that God would utilize these medicines for real needs. Here I am in the Muslim compound. This is the box, ready relief. Next. And then a number of the followers are standing out there waving their thanks to me. Next. This year, I was there for we organized iftar parties. It was during Ramadan. I arrived right at the very beginning of Ramadan, and I felt the Holy Spirit telling me to fast with the Muslims. For 25 days, I fasted. I didn't do what they do, which is eat before sunup, and I could hardly hold down any food at sundown. By the way, the Muslims eat an awful lot at sundown. Okay? They more than make up what they're missing. I lost 25 pounds in 25 days. My stomach soured. I was having dizzy spells. I was vomiting considerably. But I made this a commitment of incarnation to speak to these people, because these were the imams and the leading Muslims who come together each evening after sundown to break the fast. It's called the iftar party. And so my responsibility was to address them on what the Christian meaning is of fasting. And I would stand up in four of the cities, between 40 and 60 of these religious leaders, and say, we also as Christians fast. But we do it for different reasons. You do it to meet the requirements of salvation, one of the five pillars of your faith. We believe as Christians that God has already worked our salvation through his death on the cross. And so we do it for 10 different reasons, and I'd give the biblical reasons for it. And at the end, they all politely applauded what I had to say. But it gave me the opportunity of expressing genuine Christian witness, and many conversations evolved out of this. One man came to me, he says, I perceive that you're a very holy man. How come you're not Muslim? I thought that was an interesting lead. Next, this is another one of the iftar parties. Next, here I am assembled around a table with lawyers, Muslim lawyers. What intense conversations we had at that table. Next. And one of the cities was so dangerous, the government assigned 20 elite police to be my security guard. They had vehicles in front of me. They had vehicles behind me, all of them with their machine guns, as we went 30 miles to the community. And then they stood there while I was sharing the witness and the testimony, 20 soldiers who had to put up with my testimony. Next, had the opportunity of talking to the head of the Church of Pakistan in Multan and signing books for him. And he asked me to pray for him because this is the same church built in very much the same fashion as where the bombings took place last week in Peshawar, of the same denomination. This is his church, and he's asked me to teach there this coming summer. Next. But the most amazing story is the town of Shantinagar. Shantinagar is a community of 25,000 people in the cotton area, cotton fields all around. In 1917, a Salvation Army British fellow gave up his government position and incarnationally lived as a Pakistani to witness to this community. This community now considers itself entirely Christian. 25,000 people, 14 churches, not one Hindu temple, not one Muslim mosque. And it is a vibrant community. So vibrant that in 1997, somebody found a disfigured Quran and started the rumor that this had been caused by this community, and 45,000 people charged in, burned down 1,000 homes, chased out all the people out of the community, burned out all the businesses, burned out the hospital, the little clinic there. It was a terrible tragedy. 70 people were injured. Fortunately, nobody was killed. The government then sent in troops to protect them. Next. This is as you drive into the town of Shantinagar. Not the only Christian town in Pakistan, by the way. There are others that are larger, but this is the one with this particular violent attack. I'm teaching class here, and this is one of my students, Salvation Army member by the name of Daud. He left my class and was killed on his motorcycle on the way home. I went and visited with the family. We put together a large certificate as though he had finished the class. This is his family, his mother, his father, the five older siblings, who said, why would God take our son, our 17-year-old brother, who was so profoundly committed to Jesus Christ? I don't have answers for that. And then we had our very first vacation Bible school in this town. Temperature is 115 degrees. Intolerably hot, but 300 people, 300 children, and 80 adults working with them. And I just received last week $800 from a contributor so that we can do it again this coming summer. Oh, actually, November. And so here I am speaking to the group. You can notice some of the awards on the right-hand side for Bible memorization. Next. This is a group that's working with a nonprofit, a Christian nonprofit, where you've got 35 women under just intolerable circumstances trying to learn the trade of embroidery. Christians don't get a break when it comes to education or when it comes to business. And so they have to learn some skills. Next, this is the hospital staff in the little clinic where 50 babies are born a year. Sobia, who's the girl on standing there, she is an incredible lady who's a nurse. There's no doctor at this hospital. I'm preaching here in the Assemblies of God Church. Next. About 200 people crowded in there. They don't have instrumentation, anything like we have here. And then in the middle of the city, last year, they're building a 60-foot cross right at the intersection of the two main roads. I was so impressed, and I went back, and this year the cross is finished. What a testimony in the very heart of Pakistan. Next. And then at the base of that cross, you can see what they say. More than half the homes and all the churches were put to fire by the uncontrolled mob. However, by the grace of God, there was no casualty. And on top of that, residents of Shanti Nagar forgave all the responsible persons with a Christian concern. That's genuine Christianity. And it's found in Pakistan. This is one of the fellows who was standing right by the cross there. I invited him to church that morning. This is in the Salvation Army Church, the mother church. About 500 people in attendance. Next. The men, of course, are on one side. The women are on the other. Very intense praying. Afterwards, a string of people come to me wanting me to pray for their physical healing. Next. Then we took 14 of these students of mine up to Nepal. They funded themselves. But they wanted, 10 of them had never been on an airplane before, had never had a passport before, and had never, ever been out of the country before. We took them to Nepal. It was the great adventure of their lives. This is a country of 30 million people, estimated population of 46 million people. We've got a very fast-growing work there. People are very responsive. It is Hindu Buddhism married together. Next. I had the opportunity of catching a plane and flying around Everest. Something on my bucket list. Next. This is my photo of Everest that was seen on a clear day, and these are the stewardesses, the flight attendants that flew with me around Everest. This is looking down on the community of Pokhara at the foothills of the Himalayas. This is a lady on the boat as we went out onto Fiwa Lake. Next. Lots of interesting things for sale. Beautiful stuff fashioned by the people of Nepal. When I got into Nepal, I felt like I was out of jail again. I began to eat. I began to walk again. Next. But the hardships that people have, this lady with that big basket on her back, loading it up with this stuff, taking it on into the construction site just across the road there. Next. You can see the bathing situations where they wash their carpets and they wash their clothes and they wash themselves. Next. This is the most famous Buddhist stupa in the world. And, of course, the prayer wheels that surround it. People who believe that somehow by spinning the prayer wheel, they'll get answers to prayer. Next. Or going through certain forms of obeisance where hour after hour they go through these calisthenics in front of the stupa. Old women doing it. Next. And then I went to the major Hindu temple complex. And there they have the public cremations. I watched 7 people being cremated. And as you watch, they're carrying the bodies there. They place them on the altar. The family walks around 3 different times. You see the pain. You see the sorrow being exhibited. They finally open up the face of the deceased. They place the fire near the neck. They place the fire down underneath. And then 4 to 6 hours later, they sweep the ashes off into the river. Next. Had the opportunity of meeting with the top Catholic leader in the nation of Nepal. But in my classes were primarily Hindus and Buddhists. And by the way, the strange mix of Hinduism and Buddhism. Hinduism believes everything is God. Buddhism believes there is no God. And when I confronted people with this, they said, well, we don't think about that. It's just what we do. And so their practices and their cultures determine, rather than their theology, their behaviors. This fellow here is a Sufi Muslim. We act out in class the story of the prodigal son. I talk about 2 prodigals. I talk about the prodigal father and the prodigal son. The word prodigal means excessive. The prodigal father, representing God, is excessive in his love in the way he expresses it to his son. And so he's acting it out. These are some of my students there. Beautiful women. 2 of them are Buddhist. 2 of them are Christian. And then after all the 8 classes that I gave in Pakistan and in Nepal and in India, we'd take pictures. Pakistanis that went with us to Nepal are Christians, and they became quite an evangelistic team. They would sing to the Hindus and the Buddhists and get the Hindus and the Buddhists to sing with them. And this was my little girl that played the role of Tabitha in our drama in class. And so I had her dead in bed, and Jesus comes up and picks her up. And so I want to remember that. And then I think of the lost sheep. Next. And then I go to the strange nation of the Philippines. A very special place. Population right now is about 100 million. And by 2050, it'll be 128 million. We've got 26,000 members, 343 churches. So much more work to do. Next. You recognize this building. Next. And there's my hallway. I'm alone now. Everybody's moved out. It's my hallway. Okay? Until President M moves in. Next, this was the day of our dedication. My assistant, Larney Sam. Professor Larney Sam, soon to be Dr. Larney Sam, if he'd ever get his dissertation done. And there's one of my daughters, my Filipino daughters, Tutit. Next, dedication ceremony with General Superintendent Eugenio Duarte. And then the presentation a year ago as to the PhD program in urban ministry. Next. This painting means a lot to me, done by Joy Velasco, a man who, though Roman Catholic, sets Jesus there with 12 homeless children in Manila and puts them at the table of communion. To me, this speaks dramatically of what my mission is here in the Philippines for that generation. He painted a subsequent painting of no longer the Last Supper, but it's now the great feast in the kingdom. And now the children are all there with their toys, celebrating the extreme joy that they have in the presence of Jesus. By the way, Joy Velasco recently passed away. And out of the book that he printed called They Have Jesus, which I give away to contributors, and out of the paintings, he's been able to build homes for all of these families, which to me is a wonderful gesture. These are some of my friends. And then down to the Tai Tai Church, where we had 1,000 children for a feeding program and service there, ministering there. Masses of children everywhere. And then up at my office, Angelica came to visit me yesterday. She's 11 years old. I wish I could adopt her. But here are some of my students, some of you that have been part of my class. We do field visits for my classes. We went down to where in Pasig 400 homes were burned out. We collected clothes. Ree is here. Ree took all the possessions she had, handed them to me, and we gave them out there. This is the street that was burned out. There's one of the shelters where the families with nothing else were staying at the time. One of the things I miss very much in my life in Kansas City is music. Children and music. And so last Christmas, we sang the Messiah in the various malls. What a joy. I had not sung in the Messiah for 30 years. And Paul here and some of the others, what a great privilege. Because there's something about this culture that brings the song out in me. And I think that's one of our messages to the people around. How can you help remain curious and interested? Get on a mailing list. Pray for upcoming ministries this coming year in Myanmar, actually next month. This month, Ecuador, Trinidad, Sri Lanka, Pakistan, Nepal, Bangladesh, Bhutan, possibly Tibet. Pray for my protection and health. Pray that our PhD program and accreditation will be approved in the next several months. Pray for the financial arrangements. I've got to raise $4,000 a month just to keep this thing going. And then pray that we drop a whole new contingency of students, perhaps some of you, into preparing for ministries and into doing ministries around the world. Tuesday, I showed you my conch shell. There is a verse in which it talks in Revelation chapter 21 about the gates into the city of Jerusalem. What are they made of? They're made of pearls. Where do pearls come from? Conches. There's another word for the pearl. It's called the irritant. You understand? It's a piece of sand that irritates the flesh around it until it creates that chemical, which ultimately becomes the pearl. And every single gate into the city is made up of one pearl. Now, that's one huge clam, isn't it? Conch. I can't imagine it. The fact is, it's through the gate of suffering that people will come to Jesus Christ. You are my witnesses, you are my martyrs, that you may know and believe that I am He. Closing, I've had the opportunity of doing volunteer services at Mother Teresa's mother house in Calcutta and four of the other houses there. And I heard a story about her. Apparently one of the volunteers was so transformed by doing the volunteer services and the philosophy and the commitment to the desperate needs of dying Indian people that when he went back to Europe, he was frustrated. And he wrote a long letter to Mother Teresa, and basically the letter said, "Now what am I supposed to do?" 6 months later, he got a postcard with handwritten four words, "Find your own Calcutta." Wherever we are, there are Calcuttas. Some of you will be going to locations here in the Philippines, Taiwan, Myanmar. None of us is exempt. We all need to find the Calcuttas in our lives and minister to them. May God bless you this morning. Thank you.